Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, March 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Democrats launch a wide-ranging probe of the president.
Abuses of power into corruption and into obstruction of justice.
Across the U.S. Southeast, rescue teams continue to search through rubble of a powerful tornado, and they say the death toll could rise. Also ahead, a worldwide pop musician tries to dispel rumors that she is on her deathbed. It's all on today's International Edition. Democrats launched a sweeping probe of President Trump Monday, an aggressive investigation that threatens to shadow the president through the 2020 election season, with potentially damaging inquiries into his White House campaign and family businesses. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler said his panel's beginning the probe into possible obstruction of justice, corruption, and abuse of power.
We've seen abuses of power in an obstruction of justice, threats to the Mueller investigation, threats to witnesses. All of these have to be, and abuses of all of these have to be investigated and laid out to the American people.
The broad investigation could be setting the stage for an impeachment effort, although Democratic leaders have pledged to investigate all avenues and review Special Counsel Robert Mueller's upcoming report before trying any drastic action. Earlier, I talked about it with VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson and asked what exactly is happening regarding these new investigations.
They sent out an extraordinary number of 81 letters to a range of administration officials, Trump associates, requesting huge amounts of documents, and all within the space of 2 weeks. This material will help them investigate President Trump's finances, his dealings with Russia, the so-called hush money payments to Stormy Daniels, really a wide-ranging inquiry into the network of Trump businesses and Trump world, really.
It seems unprecedented, this many people that they want to talk to. Is this the beginning of them looking to try to make a case for impeachment?
What they want to do is lay down a groundwork. And the chairman of House Judiciary, Jerry Nadler, said on one of the Sunday talk shows that what they're looking to do is to build a solid foundation, that you cannot just go run off and impeach a president of the United States. You need to lay down the foundation and make the case to the American people that this is something you really want to put the country through. Because as we all know, those impeachment proceedings are going to tear this country apart if they do end up happening.
It could be detrimental politically to Democrats, I would imagine.
Right. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is very aware of that possibility. Last week, after the explosive Cohen testimony on Capitol Hill, of course, she was asked by us Capitol Hill reporters, what does this mean? Does this lead to impeachment? And she said she is absolutely not going to be going there until at least we see the details of the Mueller report. After that, then we can step back, we can reassess, she said, then we'll take a look at the possibility of impeachment. But she knows that having that political battle, those, you know, that back and forth with only a few months until we really start the 2020 presidential campaign, which is something that Democrats really want to win this time around. She knows that she has to play the long game here and think of a broader strategy to show that this isn't just a partisan political battle where Democrats are going against Trump for the sake of going against Trump.
Well, it should be interesting to see what happens, given that they've requested documents from the White House, from the Justice Department, from close associates and even relatives.
Trump family.
Right, the family of Donald Trump. So what happens next?
So we know that they have 2 weeks to comply with those requests, or House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler says that they will issue subpoenas. We also know that Michael Cohen will be back on Capitol Hill this week for further closed House Intelligence Committee testimony. We also know that several Trump associates will be brought in to discuss some of those Moscow Trump Tower meetings that we've heard so much about. And we'll continue to have bits and pieces of information trickle in. Of course, what everyone on Capitol Hill is waiting for is the release of that Mueller report.
All right, that's VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson.
Esta pequeña victoria de hoy, esa gira por Sudamérica.
Venezuelan opposition leader and U.S.-recognized interim President Juan Guaido returned safely to Caracas on Monday, despite concerns he would be arrested for violating a travel ban imposed by the government of President Nicolas Maduro. Last month, Guaido secretly left Venezuela for Colombia to coordinate efforts to send in humanitarian aid to alleviate widespread shortages of food and medicine. He also visited Brazil, Paraguay, Argentina, and Ecuador, neighbors that are among the U.S. and 50 other countries that recognize him as the interim leader of Venezuela. And they also denounced Maduro's re-election last year as illegitimate after the increasingly authoritarian leader banned major opposition parties from running. I talked about it with Carlos Moreo, professor at Australian National University's National Center for Latin American Studies, and asked, what is the latest?
Guaido had been out of the country for about 10 days or so, and Juan Guaido left on the 22nd of February to participate in the Venezuela Aid Live concert, and then to also participate the following day on Saturday, 23rd of February. That was a day in which the humanitarian aid was going to be forced into the country, so he wanted to be there for that, of course. I mean, he had to be there. After that, he spent a few days kind of touring the region, meeting up with presidents from Lima Group who support Guaido and support his interim presidency. And he also had several meetings, of course, with key personnel in Trump's administration, right, so Pence and others. He's now returned to Venezuela, and we were all wondering how this was going to happen. We were wondering whether it was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad that Guaido was able to return, and I am truly relieved that he hasn't been imprisoned. I think that would have been a huge mistake on behalf of the Maduro government. Of course, the Maduro government was in a bit of a dilemma, right? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, they had issued a travel ban, right? In late January, they had said that Guaido couldn't leave the country, which he defied by leaving the country in late February. So the Maduro government was in a dilemma. They had to kind of work out whether they were going to imprison him upon his return or have him free, right? Have him kind of exercise his functions. But yes, he returned on Monday on a commercial flight from Panama, and he arrived in Caracas's, you know, main international airport, and he was greeted by many of the people at the airport, and he was received by diplomats and representatives of the European Union, right, who had also issued a statement the previous day saying that it was important that he be allowed to freely exercise his functions as president of the National Assembly.
Hmm.
Some of the countries that then recognized him as interim president also added that bit, that it was important that he be allowed to exercise freely his functions as not only president of the National Assembly, but also as interim president.
Is it still possible that the government of Nicolas Maduro could arrest him? Because it wouldn't be sort of that out of character for that country and that this current administration.
There is certainly a risk. In fact, we saw a little bit of this played out earlier. So when Guaido first declared himself interim president on 23rd of January, he was briefly detained by special security forces, and the government was kind of in disarray about it. And then we had different spokespersons for the Maduro government come out and say, no, we hadn't ordered this. This was kind of an individual action by someone further lower ranking police, or, you know, there were kind of mixed messages about why this had happened. So I think this basically shows the difficulties the Maduro government had back then in dealing with this. Maybe it's now come to a position on this. But, I mean, we are seeing day-by-day actions and moves being played out by Guaido and his supporters, and, you know, that are being kind of counteracted by the Maduro government. So there is certainly a risk that this could get out of hands and maybe he could be imprisoned. But I think the Maduro government would be in real strife if that were to happen. I mean, Guaido has so much support. I mean, he's got the European Union indirectly via its member states, though the European Union itself as a body hasn't issued recognition of Guaido, but they definitely support him as president of the National Assembly. And of course, most importantly, the regional support he has from the Lima Group countries, and very importantly, the U.S. In fact, we saw Mike Pence just a few days ago say that if anything were to happen to Guaido, the United States would act strongly and decisively. And we have seen more sanctions be presented in recent days also against governors in those border states where the humanitarian aid, or where the so-called humanitarian aid, wasn't allowed in, and also against military officers in these border states that also acted against the forcible entry of the humanitarian aid. So Guaido has support. It's still a risky situation.
Where do they go from here?
Guaido is now back in the country. He's called for, in fact, when he came back on the very, so on Monday when he arrived, we had he went straight away to a rally to signal the kind of work that he's going to continue doing. So there was a large rally in Caracas to celebrate his return. There were also concentrations held throughout the countries in about half of the country's states. He's called for another massive rally to be held on Saturday. He's meeting Tuesday with some of the large unions in the country. He's announced that he's going to ask these union leaders to basically move for public servants to not recognize Maduro as president. So we have almost 50 presidents that have recognized Guaido as interim president. And he's tried to get the military on side by offering amnesty. And now he's trying to kind of work inside the country, trying to get public servants, you know, employees of the state to not recognize Maduro as president. Also, should be said that Maduro does have a lot of support within the country, and it's something that I'm always surprised to see how it's not recognized by the regional allies of Guaido, right, or by the U.S. presidency that is also acting very strongly in its support of Guaido. So this is an important factor, and some kind of solution that doesn't take this into account, I think, would bring about civil strife.
All right, that's Carlos Moreo, professor at Australian National University's National Center for Latin American Studies. Protests are continuing in Algeria against another term for ailing leader Abdulaziz Bouteflika, and despite reports, he has promised not to serve his full time if reelected in April. From Paris, Lisa Bryant reports for VOA on demonstrations that mobilized tens of thousands across Algeria, as well as Algeria's diaspora in former colonial power, France.
Roughly 6,000 people crammed La Place de la République in downtown Paris on Sunday, chanting and brandishing signs like Basta or Enough and President Not Found in reference to 82-year-old President Abdelaziz Bouteflika, who is confined to a wheelchair and rarely seen in public. Algerian Houda Omarani says Bouteflika has served his time. Five terms is too much. It's time for change. Her friend Yasmine Bouaish says Algerians aren't just protesting another presidential run. The whole power system has to change. But people don't want to return to the bloodshed and violence of 1991. The popular protests in Algeria, some of the biggest in decades, have taken both the government and experts by surprise, and they have been largely peaceful. Nobody wants a repeat of the 1990s civil war that began with the 1991 legislative election in which an Islamist party won. There's another difference today. Like other recent uprisings, this one is largely driven by social media.
All like the calls for the protests were on social media, and also social media played like main role to keep it peaceful, because people are spreading this message and they are like enforcing.
Algerian blogger Kamel Labid traveled from London to join the Paris demonstrations. Like others, he agrees there are few existing alternatives to Algeria's current government. The political opposition is aging and weak.
But in Algeria, it has 40 million people. So we can get younger people, people who can lead the country.
That may include some among Algeria's sizable diaspora in France, estimated at between 1 and 2 million people. French Algerian Majdid Messaouden is a municipal councillor in the Paris suburb of Saint-Denis.
Et nous, en tant que Franco-Algériens, on a deux pays.
Messaouden says he's proud to be both French and Algerian. It gives him hope to see the massive mobilization in his parents' homeland, with a single objective, he says, to topple the system. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Syrian Democratic Forces continue their assault on the last Islamic State stronghold in Syria. The town of Baghouz has been under siege for weeks as fighters are reportedly using civilians as human shields. Many of those civilians are women and children caught up in the conflict and unsure of who to trust. Our colleague Mario Ritter talks to VOA regional correspondent Heather Murdoch, who is in eastern Syria just outside of the battle zone, where she talks about the human cost of the conflict.
Today we heard about some civilians, and by civilians they mean women and children, that are still left in the combat zone and the internationally backed Syrian forces said they were going to slow down their assault to try to get those people out. It is reasonable to assume that those people stayed, not necessarily by choice, but there has been a safe corridor for people to come out, and women and children have all been brought to camps for the past few weeks. So, I mean, I can speculate as to why they stayed, and I would assume that has something to do with the fact that people who are left in what is basically a small refugee camp, but they're not even in the town, are the most passionate supporters of the militant group.
What are you hoping to find in the near future about the condition of women and children, and also what the Syrian Democratic Forces are trying to accomplish to finally defeat ISIS?
In terms of the women and children that have come out of this tragedy, I think what is necessary is much, much larger than something an individual camp should do. I think it has to do with what the governments of Syria and Iraq and the international community should be looking at, which is how to reintegrate this population of people that was with the Islamic State group and in many ways supported them. How for the people to live together. A lot of the people that could possibly be reintegrated into society, like children, are outcasts in many ways and potentially are facing long years in a camp, which could even increase the extremism and fester their anger over the fact that their fathers have died. And the outside world says, in a way, they're not supposed to mourn their fathers because their fathers were terrorists. I think this is fostering the next generation of extremists. And I hope that the world takes note and tries to find some solution to this very difficult problem. In terms of the military, I don't see any way around Syria existing other than defeating a group militarily like Islamic State. In terms of allowing the women and children that are coming out of ISIS territory to feel safe, it's not obvious to them, as it might be obvious to us, that the forces that are rescuing them are safer than the forces that they came from. So even children were saying that they were scared to be in the camp. And that is not because they've been abused in any way, because they said that also was true. They hadn't been abused, but because they had been told that the Syrian Democratic Forces were a dangerous group and they had lived in a town that was under attack from the Syrian Democratic Forces. So they're scared of them. And they still believe that the Islamic State protected them. So this is sort of a dangerous thing for the future, that people are so separate that they're looking at different groups as terrorist groups very separately without coming together and discussing it.
All right. That was VOA regional correspondent Heather Murdoch reporting from Syria, talking to VOA's Mario Ritter. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says the Senate has enough votes to reject the Trump wall emergency. U.S. deploys THAAD missile defense system to Israel. China accuses two Canadians of stealing state secrets. And why too few American kids study science and math. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Rescue crews using dogs and drones searched for victims amid splintered lumber and twisted metal on Monday after the deadliest U.S. tornado in nearly 6 years ripped through a rural Alabama community. At least 23 people were killed, some of them children. Dozens were missing in Lee County nearly a day after the twister struck, according to the sheriff, who said the crews had combed the hardest-hit areas, but that other places have yet to be searched. Lee County Sheriff Jay Jones says rescue crews are looking for survivors.
At this point, though, our priority is, of course, attempting to do everything we can to make sure that we're getting the area searched adequately and locating anybody else that may be trapped.
The winds Sunday afternoon obliterated numerous homes, leaving huge jumbled piles of wood and household belongings. Some homes were reduced to concrete slabs. Debris was scattered with shredded metal hanging from pine trees.
We're talking several miles that it traveled on the ground. The damage is significant. I would put it in the category of catastrophic.
The local coroner said the dead included almost entire families. The twister was part of a powerful storm system that slashed its way across the deep south, spawning numerous tornado warnings in Georgia, South Carolina, and Florida. Well, sad news coming out of Hollywood on Monday. Actor Luke Perry has died at the age of 52 after suffering a massive stroke. AP Entertainment reporter Margie Sarzaletta has more.
Luke Perry made his name as teen heartthrob Dylan McKay on Beverly Hills 90210. He also starred in the TV series Oz, played bull rider Lane Frost in the film 8 Seconds, did numerous animated projects, and more recently he played Archie's dad on Riverdale. Perry told reporters in 1998 he loved playing Dylan on 90210, but it wore him out because Dylan had so much drama in his life.
I find him physically exhausting to play, but having said that, It's the most exciting character that I've played.
I'm Archie Zaralletta.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. A multi-year mission is getting underway to explore the depths of the Indian Ocean with the aim of documenting the effects of global warming. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
The future of our planet is at stake.
Oliver Steeves is director of the Necton mission, which is loading and testing science equipment on its vessel Ocean Zephyr in the capital of the Seychelles.
Seychelles are a beacon of hope.
A collection of 115 islands in the Indian Ocean already feeling the effects of climate change, such as rising water temperatures and bleaching of coral reefs. Scientists will use submarines and remotely operated submersibles to survey marine life below depths of 100 feet. They'll also map the seafloor, dropping sensors to depths of more than 6,500 feet. Seychelles President Danny Faure.
It is important that we take decisions that are based on empirical evidence, and there has to be data.
The first stage of the mission will take 7 weeks and involve researchers from more than 40 organizations. I'm Ben Thomas.
Yet Nebersh Ngusi lost her sight at the age of 5, but she has not let her disability slow her down. A tireless advocate for people with disabilities in Africa, she's received prestigious prizes, including the Spirit of Helen Keller Award and the Alternative Nobel Prize. Ngusi recently spoke to VOA's Salem Solomon from our studios in New York. Here's her story.
Growing up in the rural province of Wallo, Ethiopia, Yetnebersh Ngusi was thought to have little prospects for success in life after she became blind as a result of meningitis.
Becoming blind was, like quite so many people, meant for my mom that, oh my gosh, it's going to be end of her life. She can only live until you're alive.
But where others saw obstacles, she saw opportunity.
Had I not been blind, I would have been early married, like at the age of 10 or 12. So I always called that being blind was my emancipator. That way it gave me the path to education and brought me to where I am today.
While other young girls were married off as child brides or forced to work at home, she was allowed to devote herself to learning. She moved to the capital, Addis Ababa, and pursued education, eventually earning a law degree. She went on to form a group, the Ethiopian Center for Disability and Development, that advocates for the rights of the disabled in her home country. Yetnebersh isn't alone in the struggle for access. An estimated 15 million people in Ethiopia live with disabilities, and they are often stigmatized by society and have heightened risk of poverty. She says society assumes people with disabilities are unable to perform even the most basic tasks.
they really get amazed when you do something because the initial thinking that they have is because if you have a disability, they think that you're full of disabilities.
Yet Nabersh's organization, the Ethiopian Center, has sought to address these barriers through job training and publications. She also advocates for legal changes, including overturning a restriction that makes it illegal for deaf people in Ethiopia to drive.
It depends how you view the person. Like, for example, if you see a person using a wheelchair, then if you say, because he's using a wheelchair, he cannot be a doctor, it doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't have any relationships.
She also has a message for allies who want to help disabled people.
So that way people can help us to unlock our potentials, to become who we can be.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
And finally today, singer Olivia Newton-John wants the world to know she is not days away from dying and is doing fine. She posted a video on social media to dispel the rumors that she had just weeks to live. The 70-year-old singer and actress from the hit movie Grease had announced in 2017 that she'd been diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic breast cancer that had spread. But on the video, she said the rumors of her demise were greatly exaggerated. Her 1980 hit song Magic from the soundtrack for the film Xanadu was at the top of the American charts for 5 weeks. It was also Newton-John's 25th hit and her 10th of 12 records that went gold. We are magic. Don't let your aim ever stray. And this I am, Shepherd. Destiny will arrive. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. Yeah.
This is VOA News. I'm